all through this whole fall, the scripture passages that we've read and reflected on have all held in common the questions that are raised when everything falls apart. When our plans, our expectations, our understanding, or our knowledge of things just unravel around us. We've seen how God shows up in the midst of it, often surprising us with new beginnings, with unexpected joy or love or hope, with deeper understanding or with corrected knowledge. And today is the last of those stories, and it is a doozy of a story. It is a story of the most extreme unraveling imaginable. It's the story of a man who lost everything. It's the beginning of one of the most profound treatments of the problem of suffering that was ever written. And so I'd like to read for you the man's story of loss. Now, I know that a number of you are familiar with the story of Job, or at least parts of it. It's still, the sufferings of Job is still kind of in our common vernacular as thinking about when we think about suffering and things going badly. I'm going to ask that we imagine us in his place. And as I read this, what I'm doing is I'm taking pieces out, because in the way it's written in the book of Job in our Bible, it's interspersed with this kind of divine drama that's going on. We see Job, and then we see what's going on in the heavenly realm, and then Job's story. And so I'm just going to read through Job's part of it to start with, because I want us to identify, if we can, with Job, with the man himself, without the other layer of it. So I'm starting at Job 1:1. There was once a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. That man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. There were born to him 7 sons and 3 daughters. He had 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 donkeys, and very many servants, so that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. In verse 13, one day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in the eldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing and the donkeys were feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans fell on them and carried them off and killed the servants with the edge of the sword. I alone have escaped to tell you." And while he was still speaking, another came and said, "The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them. I alone have escaped to tell you." And while he was still speaking, another came and said, "The Chaldeans formed 3 columns, made a raid on the camels and carried them off and killed the servants with the edge of the sword. I alone have escaped to tell you." This is a bad day. While he was still speaking, another came and said, "Your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house, and suddenly a great wind came across the desert, struck the 4 corners of the house, and it fell on the young people, and they are dead. I alone have escaped to tell you." And then, as if all of that weren't bad enough, loathsome sores appeared on Job from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. Job took a potsherd with which to scrape himself and sat among the ashes. Now, when Job's 3 friends heard all these troubles that had come upon him, each of them set out from their house. They met together to go to console and comfort him. That's a good thing for friends to do. When they saw him from a distance, they did not even recognize him. They raised their voices and wept aloud. They tore their robes and threw dust in the air upon their heads. They sat with him on the ground 7 days and 7 nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his suffering was great. Can we just pause for a moment and applaud these friends? Because in a minute, we're not going to applaud them anymore. But right now, what I love is that here's this guy who had everything, who loses everything. His grief, I mean, I don't think any of us could even comprehend the kind of grief, the kind of pain and suffering and sorrow of this man. And his friends come along, and you know what they don't do? They don't come along and say, "Buck up, God has a plan." They don't come along and say, "It's not as bad all that, things will get better." They come along and they plop down beside him in the dirt and they sit with him. They're just present with him in his pain and in his suffering. Man, best ever response to pain and suffering. it changes. The rest of the book is all about offering explanations. What on earth happened to Job? How do we explain that this good and upright and righteous man, this man who is clearly blessed by God in so many different ways, suddenly has nothing? He's suddenly been torn apart. All his children are dead. All his wealth is gone. All his herds, they're all gone. Everything is gone. How do we make sense of it? And so the first explanation that the book offers is what's interwoven in this opening story. And I just call it the divine drama. It's something that's happening in the spiritual realm. And it starts in Job 1:6, where we read, "One day the heavenly beings came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. The Lord said to Satan, 'Where have you come from?' And Satan answered the Lord, 'From going to and fro on the earth and from walking up and down on it.' The Lord said to Satan, 'Have you considered my servant Job? There's no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil.' And then Satan answered the Lord, 'Does Job fear God for nothing? Haven't you put a fence around him and his house and all that he has on every side? You've blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand now and touch all that he has. Then he'll curse you to your face.' The Lord said to Satan, 'Very well, all that he has is in your power. Only do not stretch out your hand against him.'" In other words, you can't kill him. "So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord." And this is when, one after another, in quick succession, that's when we learn that Job loses his oxen and donkeys and camels to enemies, his sheep to fire, all his servants and his children to some kind of tornado or windstorm. And yet in all of that, Job remains faithful. And so Satan comes back. Job 2 starts this way. "One day the heavenly beings came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, 'Where have you come from?' Satan answered the Lord, 'From going to and fro on the earth and from walking up and down on it.' And the Lord said to Satan, 'Have you considered my servant Job?'" At this point, if I knew what was going to happen, I'd be like, "God, stop drawing attention to Job. The poor guy, he doesn't need more eyes on him. 'Have you considered my servant Job? There's no one like him in all the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil. He still persists in his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him for no reason.' Then Satan answered the Lord, 'Skin for skin, all that people have they will give to save their lives. But stretch out your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he'll curse you to your face.' The Lord said to Satan, 'Very well, he's in your power. Only spare his life.'" And that's the point where Job's entire body gets covered in some kind of sores, from the sole of his feet to the top of his head. So that's the first explanation. There's some kind of weird divine drama going on. As part of that, Job's wife, apparently she is still around, although as she speaks, we wonder if her presence is yet just another source of suffering that Satan has put against Job. Because her response is to push Job to curse God. "How can you still be faithful to God? Curse him." And Job's response to his wife is simple. It speaks of a kind of powerless submissiveness to God's omnipotence. There's an acceptance in his words, though this acceptance ends up being short-lived. Job says this to his wife, "Shall we receive the good at the hand of God and not receive the bad?" In the King James, we read it this way, "The Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away," which is often still used today as in, yeah, bad things happen. That sucks. I think we've probably heard the phrase before. I think some of us have probably had people try to comfort us with those words before. They roll easily off our tongues, don't they? They sound really faithful. The Lord gives and the Lord takes away. They sound like the right thing to say when someone is suffering, even when that someone is ourselves. I bet we've said those words to ourselves. "There's nothing I can do. Sometimes God gives, sometimes God takes away." But if we're honest, are we really comforted by those words? It makes it sound like we're supposed to just shrug it all off, as if somehow the fact that it was God that destroyed everything makes it okay. as if God shouldn't be held accountable to the very standards of justice that he himself created. Now, Job may have sounded pious and faithful when he spoke to his wife, but it's very soon that we learn he wasn't actually feeling all that pious and faithful. He wasn't actually feeling, yeah, whatever happens, that's good. It's all in God's hands. Because as soon as we get to chapter 3, it changes. Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. Let the day perish when I was born, and the night that said a man-child is conceived. Let that day be darkness. May God above not seek it or light shine on it. And he goes on and on. And then he says, why didn't I die at birth, come forth from the womb and expire? This is not a guy who's sitting there going, yeah, the Lord gives and the Lord takes away. No, this is a God who's angry. This is a guy who's crying out. He's saying, how could this happen to me? This is awful. I wish I were dead. This suffering, the pain, it hurts so bad. I wish I were dead. And that's when the friends break their silence and start to speak, which is really too bad. I do like the way the first friend starts to speak. He's been sitting quietly with Job for a full week, just being present with him in Job's ministry. And he asks, I imagine it kind of tentative. If one ventures a word with you, will you be offended? In other words, do you mind if I say something? And then he goes on to suggest that while Job was always really supportive of others when they were going through hard times, now that it's him, it's a different story. And he sets up Job for quite the challenge. Is not your fear of God your confidence and the integrity of your ways your hope? In other words, you were so confident in God and in your own goodness when things were good. You figured all your wealth and children and health were directly related to your own good behavior, your own faithfulness to God, that God had blessed you with all of these things. Maybe the problem is that you were never really as good as you thought you were. Ugh. Maybe all this suffering, everything that's happened to you, maybe it's not that bad. Maybe it's not that unfair after all. Maybe, just maybe, God is correcting you. Maybe this is all about God's discipline. Maybe you should just suck it up. Take your lumps. Do your time. Eventually, it'll be over and you'll be blessed by God once again. But listen to how Job responds. First, he does a whole bunch more crying and yelling and wishing for death. And then he says this, teach me and I will be silent. Make me understand how I have gone wrong. Is there any wrong on my tongue? Cannot my taste discern calamity? In other words, wouldn't I know if I'd been so wrong? Wouldn't I know if I'd grieved God so much as to deserve all of this? Remember, he's lost everything. Everybody he know except his unhelpful wife are dead. They just, like his whole family, all his wealth, his herds, his flocks, his servants, they're all gone. And he's covered in sores from head to toe. Wouldn't I know if I'd done something so bad as to deserve all of this? This simplistic idea that suffering is punishment for sin, he's saying, it doesn't hold up. Life is hard after all. It's hard for everyone. And even if this is about my sin, what about everybody else? Why isn't everybody else suffering the way that I have? He says in chapter 7, verse 20, why have you, and he's speaking to God, why have you made me your target? Why have I become a burden to you? Why don't you pardon my transgression and take away my iniquity? Why don't you deal with it, God, if that's really what's going on? And so then another friend jumps in with the same kind of line of thought as the first friend. He also encourages Job to get right with God. He assumes there's a reason for all this suffering, that Job is somehow responsible for his own predicament, that if he'd just be honest and confess, everything will go back to the way it was. And this is some of what he says to Job in chapter 8. How long will you say these things and the words of your mouth be a great wind? Does God pervert justice or does the Almighty pervert the right? If your children sinned against him, he delivered them into the power of their transgression. Man, as if it's not bad enough, his kids are all dead because they sinned. If you will seek God and make supplication to the Almighty, if you are pure and upright, surely then he will rouse himself for you and restore you to your rightful place. Now, Job doesn't outright disagree, but he's feeling pretty increasingly hopeless. How can a mortal be just before God, he asks. But see, Job's hopelessness in all this, it's not just about the impossibility of a person being perfect before God. He feels abandoned by God. He feels inconsequential. This man, Job, who'd always understood himself to have a particularly close relationship with God, this man who understood that all his worldly possessions, his flocks and herds of sheep and donkeys and oxen, his servants, even his children, all of it was a clear sign of God's favor and of God's personal attention on him. But now it's all gone. Now, he says, if I summoned him, meaning God, and he answered me, I don't believe that he would listen to my voice. And even if he did, how can a lowly, simple person like me argue with God? For he's not mortal as I am, that I might answer him. There's no umpire between us who might lay his hand on us both. And then even though he's just finished saying that he can't possibly argue with God, God being God after all, Job begins to do exactly that. If you ever want a good biblical example of lament, if you're feeling frustrated or angry at God, these words of Job's from Job chapter 10 especially might be exactly what you need to pray to God. He says this, I will say to God, do not condemn me. Let me know why you contend with me and against why you're doing all of this to me. Does it seem good to you to oppress, to despise the work of your hands and favor the schemes of the wicked? Do you have eyes of flesh? Do you see as humans see? In other words, are you so different from us, God, that you can't understand what you're doing to us? Your hands fashioned and made me, and now you turn and you destroy me. Remember that you fashioned me like clay, and you'll turn me to dust again? And then his anger, it just kind of floats away, and it's replaced with hopelessness again. And he says to God, let me alone, that I might find a little comfort before I go, never to return to the land of gloom and chaos where light is the darkness. This is a man who's suffering. This isn't what one of the things I love about the whole book of Job is it's not like, oh yeah, bad things happen, but then everything's good again. We spend 40 chapters in this because that's what it feels like in our lives too, doesn't it? When things are hard, when we're suffering, when horrors happen to us, when griefs, they don't just come along and then they're gone suddenly. We're in them. We feel anger. We feel hopelessness. We feel despair. We feel hurt. We feel betrayed. We feel all of these things, and they're all in there together. Another friend joins the conversation. His name is Zophar, and he is less patient than his friends. They all have less and less patience as time goes on. And he starts like this. Should a multitude of words go unanswered, and should one full of talk be vindicated? Should your babble put others to silence? And when you mock, should no one shame you? In other words, who do you think you're talking to? Why should we be listening to you? For you say, my conduct is pure, and I am clean in God's sight. But oh, that God would speak and open his lips to you, and that he would tell you the secret of wisdom. Know then that God exacts of you less than your guilt deserves. In other words, you are clearly such a wicked man, you're clearly so full of sin, that even all of this is less than you deserve. Who are you, the friend is saying, to question God? If you were honest, Job, you'd admit that you did deserve all this suffering. You'd admit it and repent, and everything would be fixed. But Job keeps sticking to his story. He's frustrated with his friends now. It's really too bad that they didn't just keep sitting with him quietly, being present with him in the midst of his suffering. How great it would have been if instead of offering advice and explanation, they just allowed Job to yell and scream and cry and wilt and shake as he needed. Job isn't the first, and he's not the last, to be on the receiving end of well-meaning friends with all their advice and wisdom. The problem, though, was that in the framework within which they understood suffering in general, that suffering is directly connected to sin, that suffering is the evidence that someone is a bad person. If your life is awful, it's on you. It's because you did something wrong, or maybe your parents did something wrong. But sin and suffering are directly connected. But that framework was flawed, and Job saw that. But he still can't totally remove himself out of that framework. He's stuck between understanding that this is suffering, but it doesn't fit with what he's experiencing, what he knows about himself. That's why he wants an audience with God. He wants to make his case before the Almighty. What's happening isn't fair. And he says to his friends, look, my eye has seen all this. My ear has heard and understand it. What you know, I also know. I'm not inferior to you, but I would speak to the Almighty, and I desire to argue my case with God. As for you, you whitewash with lies. All of you are worthless physicians. If you would only keep silence, that would be your wisdom. But Job's friends, they don't take his complaint very well at all. The first one who spoke has this to say in a nutshell: who do you think you are? Are you so much more wise than everyone else? Do you have some kind of secret knowledge hidden from everyone else? The elders of our people, those who've been around a lot longer than we have, they're on our side in this. Are you so much smarter than those who could be your grandparents? How do you dare proclaim your innocence before God, Job? Everyone knows the wicked suffer. Even if they seem to prosper for a time, they're always found out. They always pay for their crimes. Everyone knows this. And Job says back, do you really think I haven't heard all this before? This isn't new information for me. Why do you keep insisting on talking? If our places were switched, if you were in my shoes and I was the one trying to help you, I could say all the things that you've been saying. But it doesn't help. I'm still in pain. I'm worn out by it. Everything was fine, and then God broke me in two. He seized me by the neck and dashed me to pieces. He set me up as his target. His archers surrounded me. After a bit more of this, another friend, Bildad, jumps in, reiterating the facts. The wicked suffer. Job is suffering. Therefore, Job is among the wicked and must repent. But Job, in all of this, he holds fast to what he knows to be true. Even though his entire life he's been taught exactly as his friends believe, even though he's always carried the same assumptions as they're voicing to him, he knows his torment is unfair. There's nothing like life experience to cause us to question all the things we believe, all the things we know to be true, when all of a sudden we think, this is what I know to be true about God, and something the opposite happens. We wrestle with that. That's what's going on here. It's in all of this that Job has something quite unexpected and surprising. In the midst of his anguish, in the midst of his fist-shaking challenge to God to hear him out, in the midst of his frustration with his friends who won't shut up and keep making it all worse, in the midst of his own ongoing physical pain, his grief, and his poverty, Job says this. We're way up to chapter 19 now. I know that my Redeemer lives, and that at the last he will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been thus destroyed, and then in my flesh, I shall see God, whom I shall see on my side, and my eyes shall behold, and not another. Now, if Job's friends weren't already frustrated with him, this last statement put them over the edge. How dare Job, a man who God had clearly marked as wicked, a man consistently unrepentant, how dare Job suggest that he would see God face to face? How dare Job claim God's redemption? He was not deserving. He was not repentant. He would never see God. How dare he claim anything differently? Zophar speaks righteously indignant. How can you not know that the wicked will perish? How can you not know that the wicked will be forever forgotten? How can you not know that the wicked are rejected by God? How can you not know that the only thing awaiting the wicked is God's fierce anger and their complete annihilation? How can you not know this? And Job answers again, he calling out his friend's assumptions that anyone with eyes can see doesn't hold water. The wicked do prosper, he says. And not just for a time. The wicked grow old, just like the good do. The wicked have children and grandchildren alongside the good. The wicked amass wealth and property. They have parties and celebrations. Even though they turn from God, even though they dismiss God, they don't pay for it. Something's wrong. Something's flawed in the way we're thinking about all of this. This idea that the wicked suffer just doesn't hold up under scrutiny. But you see, if Job's friends go on this journey with Job, everything they believe, everything they know about the whole universe, about everything in their lives, will collapse and crumble. Everything will fall apart. So Eliphaz says, "How dare you?" They can't let a lifetime of making sense of things go in this way. They can't risk the randomness of things Job seems to be declaring. If God doesn't punish the wicked, what's to stop anyone from being wicked? If there's no reward for being good, what's the point in being good? If Job's suffering isn't because of his sin, if Job's suffering is random, it could happen to any of us. Where's God? Who's God? Everything falls apart. But Job is living the nonsensical reality of his own suffering. It's not that he thinks he's perfect, but he also knows he doesn't deserve all of this that's happened to him. And this randomness, this huge question, this echoing why adds to his suffering. He needs to understand. We all need to understand. When horrible things happen to us, we need to make sense of it. We need there to be a reason, don't we? And for some of us, like for Job's friends, even a hint that there might be no grand reason, that our pain and suffering might be random, is almost more unbearable than the pain and the suffering itself. Job's friends, they cannot go where Job has been forced to go. They cannot allow the thoughts and the questions Job keeps voicing. I think we're often a lot like Job's friends. Not that we necessarily have the exact same understanding of God or suffering or good and evil as they did, but I think we're often uncomfortable, like they were, with Job's kind of lament. We don't know how to just sit in it. We aren't totally convinced that it's okay to say the kinds of things to God that Job has said. We live and breathe a culture flooded with self-help books, with gurus and memes, all of which declare the importance of positivity. We're convinced of our own power, power to make whatever future we want, power to pull ourselves out of whatever hole we find ourselves in. We may not blame someone suffering on their sin, but we sure are good at holding them accountable for spending too long in their lament, for taking too long to overcome their hardship. I wonder if we hold as tightly to our beliefs and assumptions as Job's friends did, even when his experience so clearly contradicted those beliefs. I hope that we have a bit more patience than Job's friends had. But I wonder, Job is afraid of this random, nonsensical God that he's experiencing. In chapter 23, we read his words, "Therefore I am terrified at his presence. When I consider, I am in dread of him. God has made my heart faint. The Almighty has terrified me. If only I could vanish in darkness and thick darkness would cover my face." See, Job isn't just afraid because of his own experience. His experience has opened his eyes to an entire world of suffering previously understood within the neat package of his friend's worldview. But that worldview no longer sufficed. It wasn't just Job's own suffering that made no sense. Nothing made sense anymore. And then finally, yet another friend shows up and has his say. And after Job is once again accused of all manner of things to explain suffering, finally, God speaks. In chapter 38, God starts. "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up your loins like a man. I will question you, and you shall declare to me." Can you imagine anything quite as terrifying? This isn't the meek and mild Jesus who sits around campfire singing Kumbaya. This isn't the all too familiar Jesus of the New Testament who went to the cross for us to cover the cost of our sin. This isn't the Heavenly Father who saw fit to adopt us as his beloved children. This isn't even the God of the first couple of pages of the story, that petty gambler God playing games with humanity. This is the Almighty, the creator of the universe, the God who breathes life and just as easily stops a heart, the God who was so incensed by the evil of human beings that he drowned everyone except a single family. This is the God who finally speaks to Job. Where were you, Job, when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurement? Surely you know. Or who stretched up a line upon it? Or on what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together and all the heavenly beings shouted for joy. Job has gone on and on and on to anyone who will listen for hours and days, all about the answers that God owes him, about the injustice of his suffering. It's not that Job ever questioned God's power and might. It's not like he decided God was ineffectual or unimportant. In all of this, he clearly continues to grasp the almightiness of God, and now this God has spoken. This God before whom Job wanted to make his case suddenly finds himself on trial. Job finds himself on trial, questioned by God. What do you know? God seems to be challenging. How can you possibly contend with me? Have you forgotten who I am? How could you possibly think you could even begin to understand my ways and my plans? Can you lift up your voice to the clouds so that floodwaters may cover you? Can you send forth lightning so that they may go and say to you, here we are? If you want to argue with me, Job, bring it on. God goes on like this over a lot. He brings up everything. And then finally, Job answers this way in chapter 42. To God, he says, I know that you can do all things and that no purpose of yours will be thwarted. Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore, I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Hear, and I will speak. I will question you, and you will declare to me, I had heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore, I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. What is he repenting? Not some wickedness that he had done that brought on his suffering. He's repenting that presumptuousness before God. He still doesn't know why he lost everything. He has no idea why God did what he did. He doesn't know the why behind his physical pain. He doesn't know why children in the world are orphaned, or why thieves go unpunished, or why murderers go free. He can't make sense of any of it. It still seems random and unpredictable, but somehow now that's okay. Somehow, instead of lament, he's at peace. How is that possible? I had heard of you by the hearing of the ear, he says to God, but now my eye sees you. In other words, I knew all about you, God. But now I know you. See, this is the gift that Jesus offers us. It's the gift that God offered Job. It's the gift of knowing God, not just knowing about God, not just knowing some facts and some things and some ideas. It's the gift of peace, even in the midst of suffering. It's the gift of rest, even when the worldly wisdom says we should be worrying and hoarding and generally doing everything we can to protect ourselves from the randomness of life. The gift that God gave to Job is the same gift that we've been given in Jesus. And it is enough. And I can't prove that to you. I can't make you believe that, because it's not a fact we just grab onto. It's an experience that we can't let go of. That when we know God, when we know we are known by him, when we experience his love and his comfort, it's like a child who doesn't understand all the things their parents does or all the rules their parent lays down, but they know they are loved, and that is enough because they know their parent. Job suddenly knew God, not just about God, and it was enough. Which I think is the most extraordinary testimony in this Bible, because we always want to tie things up in neat bows. And I love that there's a 42 chapter book in the Bible that refuses to give us a bow and instead says, there's always going to be mystery in this, but knowing God and being known by God is enough.